We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. To honor your time, we're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Christy Shelley, and I am the Chief Product Officer at Core Learning. I want to welcome and thank you for joining us for this exciting conversation today. You are in for a real treat with these two. We're going to get started on our webinar, Multilingual Learners and the Science of Reading, Building a Common Ground with Dr. Claude Goldenberg. Our moderator today is Maya Valencia Goodall, who is a pioneering force in education, driven by a singular mission to ensure that every student, regardless of their linguistic background, receives the literacy and language instruction they both need and deserve. She continues to shape the education landscape as one of the leaders in design enhancement of OLA, the Online Language and Literacy Academy at Core Learning. Maya's legacy is a testament to her extraordinary commitment to educational excellence. Core Learning is sponsoring this session. For 27 years, Core has championed the science of reading. Some people refer to Core as the OGs of science of reading. Take a moment to read the description of what we do and who we are. Our advisory board members over the years have included icons in the research on science of reading, including Joe Torgensen, Barbara Foreman, Isabel Beck, Ed Kamianui, David Chard, Louisa Motz, Mark Shin, Phyllis Hunter, and Elsa Cardenas Hagen, and Claude Goldenberg, just to name a few. All right, I'm going to introduce you to our star today. Dr. Claude Goldenberg is the former professor of education at Stanford University, and he has made significant contributions to the field of language and minority education. Originating from Argentina, his journey in education spans diverse classroom teaching, and a leading researcher in the space that we're about to dig into. And he makes a mean eggplant parmesan, which maybe he'll tell you about later. And with that, I'm going to hand the mic over to Maya. Everyone, enjoy these two.
Thank you so much, Christy. I really appreciate it. And Claude, I want to let you know that someone from Argentina is at least one person named that they were calling in and listening in from Argentina today.
Arriba, so Boca. Arriba Boca Juniors. a little coded speech there, so
okay,
never mind.
Awesome. I love it. So we are here today to talk about multilingual learners and the science of reading, sometimes called structured literacy. And that is because this is a hot topic, and there are still some questions about whether these two things go together. And so we're going to talk about how we can bring these together. And knowing that at Core, we are dedicated to promoting both multilingualism and structured literacy. We had Elsa Cardenas Hagen on yesterday, who talked to us about structured literacy and multilingual learners and how they go together. She gave us amazing practical ideas on how to teach our students. And so today, we're going to delve deeper into this topic. And we just want to level set at the very beginning to know that we promote both reading and structured literacy, and we also promote multilingualism and honor students who are bilingual or multilingual. So I thank you so much, Claude, for being here to continue
this conversation. Thank you, Maya. Thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be with you.
Awesome. So let's get started. Let's talk a little bit about the very kind of going back in history and talking about this debate and why there's even this divide or this sense of a divide between advocates for multilingualism and structured literacy. And I'm going to pull up a slide that you might refer to some of those things from. And when you do, if you can just mention to anybody who's listening via podcast, some of the words that are on the slide, if you're talking about those things.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Thanks. Yeah, and thanks for the reminder. Well, you know, the so-called reading wars have been around for a long time in one shape, fashion, or another. They go back at least to the early 18th century when Webster and Horace Mann had their debate about whether reading is basically about meaning or it's basically about decoding written language, print. Noah Webster had this syllabary that he thought was sort of the basis for learning to read. He learned the syllables, and that was sort of the forerunner of what we now call structured literacy, very sort of code-oriented, whereas Horace Mann, as many of you might know, who was sort of the father of the common school, thought that it was about meaning, meaning-driven. So it actually goes back farther than that, Rousseau, and it's the debate about how people learn and how best to teach them is far older than anyone on the planet alive today. And more recently, the reading wars has been about things like whole word, whole language, phonics, structured literacy. But the central issue has always been, do you learn to read by emphasizing the code, you know, the written code, letters, sounds, and how they combine to form words? Or do you learn to read by putting meaning first? That it's a meaning-driven activity. Reading and writing are fundamentally about communication. So why don't we put communication first in learning to read and write rather than, you know, Frank Smith wrote this infamous book called Reading Without Nonsense. And of course, nonsense referred to teaching kids to sound out words, decoding and phonics. And it was nonsense. How it seems paradoxical that you use nonsensical procedures to teach what is a fundamentally sense-making enterprise. So that's sort of the fundamental issue. You know, fast forward, we have the issue of phonics and foundational skills, foundational literacy skills, which is about phonics, but it's more than phonics. It's phonological awareness, phonemic awareness, letter sound knowledge, you know, kind of, and phonics and decoding is obviously part of it, but there's more to it than that. But let's just use phonics, you know, for shorthand. Then of course there's an
foundational skills class.
Go.
Foundational. Yeah.
Let's use foundational literacy skills. Okay. Let's not take shortcuts. I like that.
Yes.
I'm with you. I'm on your team.
Okay.
Yeah. Foundational literacy skills. That's right. Let's be clear about what we're talking about, not use shorthand, which just creates more confusion. Totally with you. So then we have the National Reading Panel, which I hope most people are familiar with, which is a report came out nearly a quarter of a century ago in 2000, that tried to summarize a big portion of the research on reading. I mean, it was just about reading. They excluded writing, which we now know is part of literacy and foundational literacy skills. But the National Reading Panel was about reading specifically. And that led to Reading First, which is one of the signature pieces of legislation in the first Bush administration. The second Bush administration. The first one was in the last century, and now it's in the current century. The second Bush, George W. Bush. And back then, what we now call science of reading, or SOR, was called scientifically based reading research. You heard the phrase, old wine, new bottles. We do a lot of that kind of thing in education, but we now call it science of reading. And the National Reading Panel is really a foundational document in SBRR, SOR, choose your term, because it really clarified and synthesized. There are a series of meta-analyses that synthesized the research and, you know, those five basic areas that we talk about all the time. Phonemic awareness, letter sounds, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension. So then the awareness came up, and to a large extent, and you heard Elsa talking about it yesterday, Reed Lyon, who was at NICHD at the time, you know, there's nothing here about English learners, and English learners are becoming, they've always been part of our school system from the founding of, before the United States was a country, there have always been English learners. But they were really
for that, Claude. I love that you mentioned that, because I think people don't always understand that this is the nature of the United States, that this is actually we've always been a country of bilingual and multilingual people.
Yes.
That is the nature of who we are here. So I think sometimes people think it's a recent phenomenon. but it's not. It started at the founding.
Absolutely. And actually, even before the United States, okay, I'm going to keep talking because Maya's feed got, so I'm just going to keep talking. As long as you brought it up, Maya, it was actually even before the United States was the United States, because the very first English learners came in the Jamestown colony in the 17th century. And guess where they were from? They were from Poland, because the Jamestown colony wanted to start a robust shipping industry. And the best shipbuilders in the world at that time were Polish. So they brought in Polish immigrants to build a shipbuilding industry. And guess what? Polish immigrants, they wanted bilingual education for their kids. They wanted a Polish-English bilingual education. So the very first bilingual education, even before the United States was the United States, was Polish and English back in the 17th century, 1600s. So they've been around for a long time, but have not always really, shall we say, informed practice and policy, specifically policy. So Reed Lyon, at the behest of Elsa and many of her colleagues down in Brownsville, said, hey, what about English learners? You've got all these kids who are bilingual, emergent bilingual. You know, what about them? And so he initiated, among other things, a follow-up to the National Reading Panel, which was the National Literacy Panel on Language Minority Children and Youth that I was on. And Reed also initiated a huge research program that Elsa also mentioned yesterday to address some of the issues of kids who are emergent bilingual. Most of them, as you know, are Spanish-speaking, but there are about 400 non-English languages going on in the homes, not necessarily in the schools, but in the homes of students in the United States. So there was a large research project that developed a very useful, robust research base on instructional practices, some of which I draw on today when I speak, or I hope we'll get into later on. So then we have emergent bilinguals, multilingual learners, you know, as I said, old wine, new bottles. They used to be called ESL kids. They used to be called limited English proficient or non-English proficient. And then they became English learners, which is a more sort of asset-based framing. And now we're hearing emergent bilinguals. And now we're hearing multilingual learners. The paradox for me is that the labels and tags change, but the challenges, both the assets, opportunities, and the challenges that these children face in school, and that the teachers who are doing their best to help educate them, the challenges have remained pretty much the same. So we have this habit of renaming things and thinking that we've sort of helped address the problem, and it's not necessarily the case. But we also know there's a very diverse population in our country in all sorts of ways, not just linguistically and culturally, but, you know, there are individuals with reading difficulties, including but not necessarily limited to dyslexia. But then fortunately, we had the IDEA some years ago that did not allow the kind of segregation that I saw when I was in school, when I was in high school. The kids in special ed were shunted off to some portable on the other side of the parking lot. And we would see them coming in and out, but they were totally segregated from the mainstream of the school. You don't see that anymore. In fact, you shouldn't see that anymore. And if you do see it, someone's violating federal law. So we've understood how diverse our population is. But then we also have speakers of non-standard varieties of English. And fortunately, you're going to have a session tomorrow with Brandy, who's going to talk about that and enlighten us all on this other aspect of our diversity. And one of the problems we've had is that people tend to take sides. And I understand that. You know, I understand that because parents of kids who've had reading difficulties, or whether it's dyslexia or something else, feel that the schools have not been well equipped to handle their children's issues. And they have to sue school districts, sue for IEP attention. There's been a tremendous amount of grassroots movement by parents of dyslexic kids who feel like, listen, we have some knowledge, that would help mitigate, if not prevent, some of these problems. And then when they do occur, we can actually deal with them. But schools are not using this information. We have advocates for English learners, parents and researchers and advocates are saying, wait a minute, we're not paying attention to the needs of our English learners. Okay, you had this national literacy panel that Elsa talked about yesterday, but they've not really been attended to in policies of the states. And we have non-standard speakers. So we have a lot of people advocating for different subgroups of kids. And I began what we're going to be talking about in the next few minutes under the assumption that, wait, there is common ground here. We don't have to fight tooth and nail over every single issue because we all have certain things in common. An obvious one is we want all our kids to succeed. I mean, it's in everyone's interest to have a school-age population that grows up to be adults that are literate, educated, responsible, and can carry on the work of the society in a responsible sort of way. So if nothing else, we all should base our activities on that fundamental agreement. And I think there's some more agreements, and that's what we're going to talk about now.
I love that, Claude. And I love that you took time to kind of name the background and name this concept that different people think or had thought that, you know, we have to kind of be in our separate corners, quote unquote, fighting for specific things when really we have the same goal in mind. And that is achievement for our students and that, you know, all of our students get to be full complete in terms of learning how to read, be successful at school, be successful in whatever it is that they choose in their life. So that moves us on to thinking about and talking about, you know, how you started thinking about finding this common ground and giving us, not only were you thinking about finding common ground, but you really wanted to produce something, have something tangible that people could look to, that they could read, that they could refer to. So if you want to give us a little bit of history on, there is actually a paper that is called Narrowing Down to Find Common Ground, Shared Agreements for Effective Literacy in Instruction in California. And I know that you started in California. It's your state, my state too. And it's a place to begin, but this is not where it ends. So we'll start with this, just giving us some background here.
Okay. And Maya, I want to make sure I point out to our listeners that you are an integral part of this activity. So I'm going to rely on you to chime in, interrupt me, give your own side of the story. I think in most respects, we see it, you know, pretty similarly, but you played a really important role from your background and your activity in making this successful. So I want to make sure that whatever perspective you have on it is represented well.
Thank you.
So I actually, this, you know, starting this activity was actually not my idea. I mean, I've been trying to figure out how to deal with the reading wars just about, you know, as long as I've been in education. I mean, when I was in PhD school, UCLA, more years than I care to remember, I was sort of vaguely aware of them. I knew Gene Schall's classic book, Learning to Read, The Great Debate. And I did my dissertation on a group of about a dozen kindergartner kids who at the end of kindergarten were at risk for reading difficulties. And I expected some of them to actually do better than expected. That's the nature of these prediction instruments. They're not perfect. You have false positives, you have false negatives. And so I was assuming that this group of kids, some would end up doing better than predicted. And so I wanted to follow them for about a year and a half, 15 months, to see if I could figure out why some did better than expected. But it wasn't really until I left graduate school that I realized how deep and profound this whole reading wars thing was. And I discovered all sorts of things while I was teaching, both because I learned a bunch of stuff from my colleagues that I never learned in PhD school. We can get into later if you're interested. But also because I learned that there was a whole body of, you know, neurological research on, you know, the brain learning to read. And I mean, I was completely unaware of that when I was in graduate school. Yeah. And at first I was sort of skeptical. There was a famous paper written by someone who said that neuroscience is a promissory note to education. This was like 30 years ago. But so far, it's not really proven to be really useful. And for a long time, I thought, yeah, okay, you know, you got a brain and people are looking at it and seeing, you know, fMRIs and so forth. But tell me how that helps me, a teacher. You know, I mean, I want to. And it wasn't until years went by that I realized that there's something really important there that a lot of people are simply unaware of for one reason or another. So it's been something I've been concerned about for a long time, but it wasn't until I was asked by the former president at Pivot to, he had the really great idea of trying to bring people together to try to find, I don't know if you use the term, I really don't remember who first used the term common ground. I mean, it seems like it's become part of the vernacular now. I'm afraid, like many things in our field, it's going to become a cliche and kind of superficial and people toss it off. So I say it, happy to address it, but worried that, like in educate, a lot of these terms just, I don't know, just something happens to them and they go, I don't know, they go rogue or something. I don't know. Anyway, he asked me if I'd be interested in working to develop some kind of consensus because the California ELA, ELD framework, this is very California-centric, I got to admit. The California ELA, ELD framework was coming up for renewal. And he said that typically what happens is, you know, all the partisans choose their warriors and they get into a room and they sharpen their stakes. And they hold their ground and they go to their corners, all those things, Maya, that you mentioned. And he said, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. So if we can get some people together to kind of suss out some of these issues and discuss, you know, where we can agree and where there still remain, it might kind of get ahead of the curve there. Well, long story short, that ELA-ELD framework reformulation got kicked down the road. And I still don't know if it's on the agenda for CDE. Maybe someone listening in from the Department of Education can tell us. But we still had a mission. You know, we still had a mission to try and find some, what we ended up calling common ground, because I knew it existed. The folks at Pivot that I was working with knew it existed. Eduardo Munoz, who helped actually spearheaded the methodology for doing this project, we all had a very good sense that it existed. And the question was trying to find it, not force it out. You can't force it out, but find it. So we identified a number of people, and you see them on the list. Elsa was on there, obviously. Maya was on there, people from Decoding Dyslexia, people from West Ed, academics from UCLA and UC Irvine and Loyola Marymount, advocates for various positions. Kareem Weaver was there, who's become a very strong advocate for the African-American community. And we had a series of meetings, beginning with one-to-one interviews that Eduardo did on Zoom, recorded, that I would then watch. And then after I watched them all, he and I got together. And I mean, this is, you know, for you research nerds, this is, I think this is a version of grounded theory. I hope I'm not bastardizing the term, but we tried to start with a blank slate to the extent that's possible, right? No one's a blank slate, but we began with, and I hope Maya, you'll back me up on this or not. If you disagree, go ahead. We began with a series of like open-ended questions asking, what do you see as the big issues? The yes. big issues, the big controversies, the things that people get all in a huff about that you think we need to put on the table and do something about. Right.
Yes.
We began with a series of questions like that. Maya, would you agree? Would that be a reasonable?
You did. It was. And just from the perspective, it was a welcome conversation. It was great. It was a very important way to be able to share what one thought were the most important conversations that needed to be had. And there was, I'm just going to move us a little bit along in the conversation because they started with the one-on-one conversations. And there was more than one time that those conversations were one-on-one. There were coming back again, asking and making sure that those particular topics were the right ones that were landed on. And then we got into a room together, all of us together. So now you're going to talk about your point of view and you're going to share what's most important to you with a group of people who you know they have other things that they think are more important. And that makes a difference when you're actually speaking to someone face to face in a room and you're not responding on email, you're not talking on Zoom, but you're physically sitting at a table and a desk and you're sharing food and you're sharing water and you're discussing these things. You realize, to your point, Claude, that we all have the same goal in mind. And that really helps to find the common ground, right? You're really wanting to center on what is important is actually the kernel of what's important is the same for all of us. And that actually led you. I'm going to move us to this slide so we can talk about how we moved on, because I want to talk about the agreements. We're actually going to go into them. But I want to just share that from that work in California, you were able to actually move it along to a more national stage with the Reading League and really getting a summit that happened together at the Reading League, again, which is, you know, heavily focused on science of reading, structured literacy, brain science, and bring together multilingualism, bilingual advocates. And it's just so funny to me that somehow there's different, because I feel like if this is a Venn diagram, I've always been in the middle. I advocate for both of these things, learning how to read and maintaining heritage language and becoming bilingual. So I just love that you were able to uplift this and bring these two kind of big groups who in the past have been on opposite sides, even though technically that kernel, like we all have the same goal. So
you give me too much credit because I did not spearhead this. I did not uplift the common ground to this. I was a player. I participated in this, but this was not me sort of engineering, you know, like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, you know, moving things. This was something that happened pretty much at the same time. It was pretty much in parallel with what was going on in California. And I'm just very, very briefly, because I appreciate you wanting to move ahead. What happened was the National Committee for Effective Literacy last year, or maybe it was the year before, I can't even remember, published a white paper and a webinar that was extremely critical of the science of reading. In fact, saying that it was detrimental to English learners. It was, let's just say, very confrontational. And I read that paper with the same idea that I had doing what I was doing in California, that, wait, there's common ground here that people are just don't know or are refusing to acknowledge, whatever. So a group of us, including Elsa, wrote a response, again, trying to find some common ground, but pointing out some things that were really in error in that paper. And that really began a series of meetings that were organized by Carrie Curto at the National Reading League involving National Committee on Effective Literacy and the Reading League.
They should be fused.
Okay, you know what? There you go. From your mouth to Carrie's ears.
Yes, I know that the link for both the Common Ground paper and for the Reading League have been dropped into the chat. So let's move on and let's spend some time talking about the agreements. What are the agreements? And these, I'm just going to say from the top, here's the topics that needed to be narrowed down. I remember talking about this and saying when I was in my one-on-one interview, we have to talk about multilingual learners. And I'm going to circle back for just a minute, Claude, because me and you are word people. We care about the words. And so moving from, limited English proficient to on the panorama to multilingual learners, it matters. Because a multilingual learner, what we mean when we say that, we mean that we honor heritage language, that the language someone speaks at home is valuable. It is cognitive background. There's a lot of fertile ground there. And you and I both know that in the past, the heritage language has been seen as a barrier, something to remove, something to get over, something to dispose of. So multilingual learner as a label, it's still, we still have to do things. We still need to use effective instructional strategies. We still have to teach English, but we can do it in a context that honors. And that's really key, especially for us who are words people. So that was a key area that we had to discuss. We had to discuss the foundational literacy skills, and we should probably have that there on the screen. It says foundational skills, and we can add in literacy skills, very important. And then this concept of universal screening. And when we get there, I'm going to talk a little bit about the controversy there and maybe some of the nuance of why that one in particular, I think, was a hotbed. So let's talk about the reasons to be optimistic, Claude. Tell us just, and I want to point out one thing. Optimism, according to Arthur Brooks, who is a professor at Harvard on the science of happiness, optimism
he's
is
a,
something.
He's a happiness scholar.
He's the happiness scholar. Optimism is something that is like outside of yourself. You can just, you feel optimistic, but you don't necessarily have agency over it. Hope is when you have agency over something. You feel like you can actually do something to create a better or happier or more easeful way forward. So I would just want to say that I'm both optimistic and hopeful based on these things. Over
well,
to
that's
you.
That's good. So just a question, Maya. So you went through the previous slide. Are we going to talk about those or not?
I want to move us because you're going to go through. You're going to talk about them in the slides themselves. So
okay.
Why don't we go?
So that was just
a teaser.
A heads up. Okay. So do you want me to talk about optimists or are we skipping that too?
You can talk about optimists and then we'll move on to multilingual.
I mean, for me, the main reason to be optimistic is that in fact, the fact is, there are many agreements on important issues in the field of literacy research that we can build on. I mean, that to me is the biggest reason for optimism. It's factually based. Now, there are lots of reasons for pessimism because it really depends on what people do. You know, you can have the facts on the ground, which I firmly believe are what I said. There are lots of grounds for optimism, grounds for agreement to build on. But if people don't act on that, right, if they willfully ignore or are not aware of those facts and what the research says, then and policymakers are unaware of it, and then that's the grounds for pessimism. And frankly, my optimism is kind of balanced by my pessimism because I don't see a whole lot of evidence that the agreements that we reached are actually being built on.
Okay, I know well, let's talk about the agreements, Claude. Let's keep
okay,
with the
okay.
Let's
okay,
keep on.
I just wanted to put in a word for pessimism, not so much pessimism, but skepticism. I want to put in a word for skepticism because, you know, we need to be skeptical. People can say all sorts of things, but if action doesn't lead to some desired state, then it's just all talk. And that's my concern. Okay, agreements. Here we go.
Okay.
Well, the first one is on multilingualism. And I'll just read off some of the words on the slides for the people who are listening. We need comprehensive literacy programs. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. We need to build oral language, listening and speaking. We need to build reading and writing. And we can talk about the difference between oral language and written language, which is a fundamental issue I think that most people don't fully appreciate. But to multilingualism, the issue here is that you can read, write, speak, listen, and learn all of those in two or more languages. I mean, most people around the world are at least bilingual.
Yes.
In fact, the United States is really an outlier. We are maniacally monolingual. And there are all sorts of reasons for that. Insularity, xenophobia, right? We don't need to get into the socio-political, historical, but we are maniacally monolingual. And it is, I think, pretty well accepted by people who study this and people who don't study it but live around the world that it's possible to become bilingual or multilingual. And that's something that we need to build on.
Yes. And I just want to say, Claude, that it was wonderful to speak with people from, you know, let's say the structured literacy or science of reading kind of like camp and the bilingual advocacy group, because, you know, we have to be honest and understand that science of reading and structured literacy hasn't always promoted multilingualism. There has been a time when the most important thing was learning English, and it was centered in that way. And when it was centered in that way, learning English became an intervention activity, right? And we know that learning English by becoming bilingual is really an opportunity for bilingualism. Learning English isn't necessarily always an intervention activity. So this agreement by all the parties, it seems so obvious, but it wasn't necessarily obvious when everyone started talking, because in the structured literacy world, as I just said, learning English was front and center, the most important thing, and the other parts of it weren't necessarily uplifted.
Yeah. My take on it was it was just not an agenda item. It was just not an item on their agenda.
Right.
So in some cases there was some opposition, but really it was not something. But what I've been quite pleased and impressed with is how willingly, when you put it on the table, as we did, literally put it on the table.
Yes.
And other interactions I've had with the Reading League folks and the Code and Dyslexia folks.
Yes.
I've seen nothing but support for expanding our educational and linguistic horizons.
100%. It has been. It's so, see, reasons for hope, reasons for optimism, because it's been, it once it was put on the table, it was accepted as an agreement. And I love that. And so just bringing in some of the context, why it wasn't on the table before is key. So I will move us on to the next agreement.
So this next one is, it says foundational skills. And as Maya, you pointed out, it should say foundational literacy skills, because there are also foundational oral language skills.
True.
In fact, and Maya, you're going to love this. Oral language is foundational to literacy.
Indeed.
You know, oral language, speech, came first in human evolution, and it's acquired naturally. Literacy is a human invention that came several hundred thousand years later. Literacy's got to be learned one way or another. Now, some kids pick it up very easily to the point of it seems natural. Other kids have a tremendous amount of difficulty. Most of the rest of us are somewhere in between. But foundational literacy skills are absolutely essential, non-negotiable for learning to become literate, whatever language, and whether you're monolingual, bilingual, trilingual, they're absolutely fundamental. Print concepts, phonological awareness, letter sound knowledge, word recognition by phonics and decoding, with then meaning playing a confirming role. And then fluency with phonics, decoding, and confirmatory metacognitive processes. You want a comprehensive language arts program that helps students attain the highest possible levels of literacy development. And one of the things that means is you don't try to do everything all together all at once, because you have to get those foundational literacy skills seeded so that kids become fluent in them. At the same time, while you're working on those foundational literacy skills, at another part of the day, after lunch, during oral language development, whatever, you want to do read-alouds. You want to do lessons and activities that build content knowledge. We know that vocabulary, oral language, content knowledge are fundamental for progressing in your literacy. But you want to make sure that those don't crowd out specific, explicit, systematic focus and attention to foundational literacy skills. And we had some agreement on that. In fact, the footnote down there says foundational skills, literacy skills, should be taught explicitly and systematically and based on students' strengths and needs. That was an extremely important agreement. It took a while to get there, but we got there.
Yes. And I love this one because it's a both and. So it's not an either or. It's not comprehension or foundational skills.
Exactly.
It's a both and. And I think that's a wonderful place to go. So then we moved to this agreement with multilingual learners, the students themselves. This one is a very specific California verbiage that multilingual learners, students who come to school to learn English, should have two separate times during the school day to learn a language. We call it English language development in California, that there should be a time where this instruction is integrated into the entire language arts time, and that there should be this separate time for studying the language, much like we see in a foreign language class. Like if you imagine yourself in middle school or high school, if you were in the United States and you took that foreign language class, or if you're from around the world listening, when you go to school and you learn that foreign language, we need both of these. And that's because we require different things from our students in the United States who are coming to school to learn English. It's not just about language that they use, informal language, but they also have to know scholastic language, academic language. They have to be able to use that English to further their educational skills. I'm just going to speak to this slide and I'm going to move us on, Claude, because I want you to talk about the universal screening. So universal screening, this was a hotbed of, this one took a while as well. So give us some more insight into this.
Well, one of the issues here, and as I said before, one of the reasons my skepticism or pessimism pops up, is that in the original wording of the agreement, the original wording said universal early screening to screen for dyslexia. And Elsa was one of the many folks who said, wait a minute, that's really a mistake, because first of all, you can't screen for dyslexia in kindergarten. You want to use certainly reliable, valid, linguistically, culturally appropriate instruments. There was no disagreement on that. But you can't really start talking about dyslexia until kids have had some degree of instruction. You got to teach them. You got the phonological awareness and letter sounds, all those foundational literacy skills, which we're not born knowing or understanding. You got to teach kids that and then see how they respond to the instruction. So there were some, advocates, decoding dyslexia who were extremely, that was one of the things they were most interested in. But I think they finally saw the benefit of talking about universal screening for reading difficulties, because reading difficulties includes dyslexia. You don't need to be so restrictive as to say universal screening for dyslexia. I mean, first of all, it's a mistake, because you're being too restrictive. There are more reading difficulties kids have than just dyslexia. And the second issue, which is really more a strategic one, it's a lightning rod, because a lot of our colleagues had experiences themselves with their kids or the teachers or themselves where there was really premature assignment of a dyslexia label, right? Mm-hmm. People's experiences in this regard is as much as I'm a big fan of relying on research, you can't ignore people's personal histories and experiences. And if you have personally experienced a situation where half of your class, as one of our colleagues told us, half of her class was deemed dyslexic in fifth grade, well, what up with that? I mean, that kind of, as an educator, that kind of scars you for life. And so
yes.
The concern about premature labeling of dyslexia is a real one. So we massage the language. So we talked about the importance of universal screening within an MTSS framework, right? Because the other thing about screening is if you collect this data and don't do anything with it, you're wasting everyone's time. And if teachers don't understand how to interpret it, don't understand what it means, you've not identified a dyslexic kid in kindergarten. You've identified a kid who maybe has phonological, weakness. Maybe they have poor short-term memory, or they don't have a lot of literacy in their home, right? So if you jump to these conclusions, it's extremely dangerous. So we need safeguards. We need training of personnel. We need to make sure that there's accurate interpretation and that there's something instructionally done after the screening is done. So all of those had to be massaged in to really adequately describe what we were talking about. And it was not an overnight thing. This was one of the last things we ended up massaging in the post face-to-face meeting. as we were massaging the report and taking a look at specific issues and listening to the recording again to see what people actually said, because we recorded the face-to-face conversation. And it was an important one, but I think it's, I mean, I think these three agreements are extremely important. And I would, I'd say it's a tie among these three. And this one I was particularly proud of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just add, you know, in terms of for the universal screening, everything that you just said is really important and also applies to language learners. So, you know, not having someone identified as having a reading difficulty simply because they don't know English yet. And that used to happen in the educational system. You talked about the special ed and what it used to look like back in the day, you know, with students being ushered off into the portable on a separate section of the campus. And that happened to a lot of, you know, language speakers, English learners at the time that they were called, or limited English proficient, very deficit oriented, then tested in English and then, you know, sent off to special ed when simply...
They'd be punished for speaking Spanish. I mean, Elsa can tell you horror stories. Antonio Fierro, another colleague of ours, they experienced exactly that. That's part of the history here that we cannot ignore.
Yes, and it's part of my history that you know too, Claude. Mm-hmm. So that brings me to this, speaking of Elsa Cardenas-Hagen, you know, she says, it's the knowledgeable professional implementing evidence-based practices who will have the greatest positive impact upon their students. And I think both you and I agree with this statement. And just speaking about that lived experience that you were pulling up. So when we were together talking about the common ground, we all, of course, naturally bring our lived experience. And for me, talking about being punished at school, it didn't happen to me. It happened to my grandmother. So she took that very deeply. And she stopped speaking our heritage language at home. And so two generations later, that trauma that was sustained in the school campus was passed on. And so I didn't have the opportunity of speaking my heritage language at home. I learned it, Spanish, later in university. But it was always something that is one of my motivating factors of why I'm, you know, work in this field and do the things I do. So, Claude, I'll pass it to you. Tell us a little bit about your why.
Well, my why is, I mean, the reason I got into education some time ago was for what we now, I don't know, it seems like a cliche. It's now called social justice. I mean, back then it was sort of on the heels of the civil rights movement. I mean, it's a fact that the large segments of our population, there are huge opportunity gaps and resultant achievement gaps. And I just wanted to work in a field where I could help address that. And education seemed like a way to go. And since I'm from Argentina, I speak Spanish. Not everyone from Mexico might agree that an Argentinian speaks Spanish, but that's okay. I speak a variety of Spanish. Brandy will tell you more about that tomorrow. My parents were living in San Antonio at the time, and so I went back to San Antonio to teach there. And ever since then, my concern has been, I mean, kids in general. I mean, whether African-American or white kids or Appalachian kids or English learners, or, I mean, just promote educational opportunities, which is, you know, it's kind of a old liberal nostrum that educational opportunities open up life chances. I mean, I still sort of believe that, even though sometimes it's hard to reconcile with reality. But that's why. I mean, that's why I got into what I'm into. And English learners in particular, which doesn't mean I don't care about other populations of kids. But, you know, just because I spoke Spanish, I thought I had an extra set of tools that I could bring to the table. And that's my why. I mean, that's the only reason I continue doing this and trying to help kind of bridge the gaps and reconcile differences and point out common ground where it exists, but continue working on issues. We still need more research. We still need more, you know, thoughtful figuring things out, right?
It's never going to end. Yeah.
I mean, asking a researcher if we need more research, like asking your barber, do you need a haircut?
Yes.
So in my case, the answer is yes to both of those. But the fact that we need more research should not stop us from using what we have
exactly.
to good effect. And that's exactly. what drives me crazy when I hear some EL advocates say, well, there's not enough research to do anything on. That is untrue. Do we have every question answered? Obviously not. But we know some things that will help us do better if we have the knowledge, if we have the understanding and the insight. And I think if I could say one thing to our colleagues listening here is please get these two reports, read them. They're not exactly scintillating reading, right? I wouldn't take them to the beach because you'll go to sleep and wake up with a sunburn. But they're decently written, understandable, and they make a number of really important points in addition to identifying things that we still need work on. And try to inform yourselves. And honestly, be careful about what you believe because there's a lot of misinformation out there. Some of it purposeful, some of it inadvertent. And we need to kind of stamp out misinformation and inform ourselves as much as possible. That's the, I think, only way forward.
Thank you, Claude. Thank you. And I'm going to take this moment to give a little sponsor moment. You know, taking the concepts of multilingualism, of structured literacy, of universal screening, and through that common ground is the type of work that I do, that Christy, who started us off today, we do. And so we're in the middle of creating Online Language and Literacy Academy, affectionately known as OLA, which is professional learning that in structured literacy, specifically tailored for the language diverse classrooms. So as you can tell from Claude and I's conversation, the multilingual learners, English language variety speakers, students who may have dyslexia, those are the students that we think about and care about and have personal lived experience that bring us professionally to this work. And so centering those students with structured literacy is what we do. And we have an online program that is available, a course for teachers to take so that you can learn how to apply structured literacy with that diverse classroom.
Thank you, Maya and Claude. This was amazing. You were just speaking about this a few minutes ago, so I'm going to bring this question up first. Claude, can you clarify the difference between evidence-based and science-based?
Between evidence-based and?
Science-based.
Oh, science-based. Well, let's see. Well, I'm going to sound like a nerdy academic because they can be defined as being identical or being distinct. So science, you know, I'm going to say they're the same thing, you know,
well,
because what happened, let me just say this one thing.
Yep.
People have a misconception of science, right? They think science equals certainty. And science doesn't necessarily equal certainty. You know, science tries to make probabilistic statements. You know, if you do this, you're more likely to get good effect than if you do that. So it's not certainty. Now, I use evidence to inform what I do. Do I do a scientific experiment on everything? I hope not. I mean, I'd never leave my house. I'd be doing experiments. So you look for evidence. You know, evidence could be, well, an experience. It could be something that you experience. Like, I know people have inappropriately been labeled dyslexic and prematurely. Now, it turns out there's some scientific evidence to that effect, but I don't need to be convinced by that because I know it happens. So that's evidence. Is it scientific, in a sense, rigorously collected and experimental and with experimental controls? No. So I guess maybe evidence-based would be sort of a weaker form of scientific. That's the best thing I could suggest.
Okay.
And I was just going to restate back to you, Claude, what you taught me. So, which is that. So, you know, if you do something with an expected outcome and you can get a reasonably expected outcome over and over again, science and evidence-based is what you're looking for.
They get closer and closer, right?
Yes.
All right. This question has come up and someone has seconded it, so I'm going to read it. Do you have more resources related to culturally and linguistically appropriate screeners?
Yeah, you should have asked Elsa that yesterday. you know, there are some out there. More are being developed. Lillian Duran, one of our colleagues in Oregon, is working on that. I think what I'm going to defer that, and we're going to put it in the, because Elsa has a list of those. I was on a recent webinar with her. So I'm going to defer that and put it in the resources to go out with the video, if that's okay.
Okay. That's great. That's wonderful.
And a lot of people have been asking for the reports and some of the other resources. Please look for the EdWeb comments in the chat. They have given some links on how you can receive the information, receive this deck today, and it will have all those resources. So there's a lot of those questions on that. I'm going to leave with this final question, and then we'll wrap up. What are one or two of the biggest changes or additions to the successful approach to teaching literacy in the next few years? So like, what do you see in the future? Be the future teller, Claude, what do you see?
Yeah, well, yeah, great question. Well, the first one is related to the last question, you know, getting screeners and assessments that we feel more comfortable making judgment. I mean, you screen, you assess, you test to inform yourself and your students as to what needs to happen next, right? Unless you're doing some kind of summative accountability thing, which is like a different, but I'm thinking about screening and assessment and testing from a teacher's standpoint. It wants to give you information about where you need to go next in helping the student. And we have a lot of assessments, you have a lot of screeners, but not all of them are equally appropriate for different kids who have different experiences, different linguistic and cultural backgrounds. So I'm hopeful that one of the projects called Multitudes in California is going to make some great strides forward. There's some that have been worked on. Doris Baker has written about this. So we're making progress in getting screeners and assessments that are valid for more and more groups of kids. But we got a lot of different groups of kids. We have kids from different language backgrounds. We have kids from different, you know, with different levels of difficulty. So I'm hopeful that we'll really press forward on that. And then secondarily, help teachers, educators understand how to use those data to inform their instruction going forward. So I'm going to put a lot of eggs in that particular big basket.
I like that basket. That's a good one. Screeners, yes. Professional learning, making sure that teachers know what to do. Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you both for such a great session today. Lots of thank yous, lots of comments about how wonderful this was today. So please read through those. We want to thank all of you for joining us today. Don't forget that we have one more day of this awesome week that we're having. Dr. Brandi Gatlin-Nash will be joining Maya tomorrow. Please join us if you can. If not, sign up and watch the recordings. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Christy. Thanks, Maya.
Thank you.
Thanks, Claude. Thanks, Maya.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.